Accession number 30249, reel 14.
Gordon Mosher, reel 13. So, having had your second tour to Afghanistan, were you going to have a rest now? This would be 2002.
Yes, it was an enforced rest because I wasn't asked to do anything else for a while.
How did you adapt to that? Did life seem a bit boring?
Yes, it's a short answer. And when the British and the Americans went into Iraq to depose Saddam Hussein, and I was all the time hoping that I'd be asked to go and work. And in fact, I did. I'd mentioned it to several people, but it was met with sort of blank stares. Really, it was quite obvious that it was far too dangerous to take the likes of me in, and quite right too. I mean, since people have said we should have taken you in early on into Iraq during the invasion, but it would have been extremely dangerous. And the military can't take the risk, to be honest, and which I understand. But I would, if they'd have asked me at that early stage, I would have gone. I would have been happy to go in. So I sat really watching the noise and news and phoning various friends who were going in and out of Iraq. You know, what's it like and what's happening and how's it going and. And everybody was making warm noises about, we really should get you in here, you know. And then in 2004, the good old Dutch Marines popped up above the horizon again. They called me up and said that we're in Iraq. The main war fighting as such was over, so the Dutch were there with a multinational force doing what was laughingly called peacekeeping. It's quite aggressive peacekeeping in my book. I mean, I thought it was low level war fighting, a lot of it. Anyway, the Dutch said, we're here, we would like you to come in now and have a look and produce a series of paintings for us, because we're doing all sorts of exciting things and we need this recording and we have a budget. So I started to prepare, and I was absolutely delighted, you know, because I've got to the point now where I feel guilty if I don't go. My friends or my boys are there. Well, I can't, I don't want to miss this, you know. Anyway, so the Dutch started to make plans for me to go, and we were well down the road. We were 3 or 4 months into planning it, and then I got a call to say the Dutch Ministry of Defence have got wind of what we want to do with you, and they have forbidden you to go. It's too dangerous. So my heart sank, and then in the next sentence the man said, but we've got a way around it. And the commander of the Dutch Marines had decreed that I was going hell or high water, you're going. And you know, has instructed his boys to find a way around it, just because the Ministry of Defence have forbade him to go. You find a way around the problem, because we want him in there to do the job. So the Dutch Marines said, well, what we'll do, we'll talk to the British Royal Marines and see what we can do there. So they phoned, they talked to the British Marine liaison officer in The Hague and said, here, you know Gordon, you know what Gordon does, and we need to get him into Iraq, and we can't get him in under our own flag. Can you do anything for us? So the Royal Marines agreed to take me in on one of their flights, on a British flight to Basra. And then the plan was that they would fly me in with them, and then they'd quietly hand me over to the Royal Marines when we got to Iraq, to the Dutch Marines, sorry, when we got to Iraq. And that's what happened. So I flew into Basra, first time into Iraq. I mean, much I knew what to expect by now, you know, going into these countries. We flew in the dark, with body armour on. I'd got issued with some body armour this time because we're flying into a, you know, into an airport that is under mortar fire and all sorts of stuff, you know.
You would have a helmet as well.
Yeah, I usually get a helmet given to me at some stage during the trip. I must have had a helmet at that stage, I suppose, going in. I kind of had body armour. So we flew in the middle of the night with all the lights out, which is always quite, well, not frightening exactly, but, you know, you do reflect on your life as you fly in. And everybody does. It's not just me. All these seasoned sort of soldiers and you know, the nurses, and they all, you can see they all go awfully quiet. We flew in, and it was early in 2004. It was probably January, February 2004. So it was still, wasn't too hot, fortunately. It was fairly cool. We flew into Basra. I got off, I walked down the steps off the plane. At the bottom of the steps there were four Dutch Marines waiting for me. Sergeant Major, I don't know, a corporal and a couple of privates. And they were part of the Dutch contingent's media ops team. They had a team that were handling television and news visitors and dignitaries and this sort of thing, and they'd got lumbered with the war artist. And at that point I didn't know where I was going or what I was going to do. I only knew they were in Iraq and I was going to do something. they took me into the airport building, which was like the interior of one of Saddam's palaces. I mean, it was pink marble, and it was a beautiful, beautiful building surrounded by sandbags and barbed wire. Got into the building. Sergeant Major pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and popped in front of me and said, "We can't do anything until you sign this." And it was in English, and basically it said, "If anything happened to me, it was my fault, and I had no claim against the Dutch government or the Dutch Marines, or had no claim against anybody," which I was expecting. So I signed it. And then we decided we'd have a cup of coffee before we left to go up country. So we walked into the sort of coffee bar in this reception area and sat down for a coffee and started to sort of, you know, you get the small talk over. It's always a bit difficult the first half hour to get, because they don't know whether I can do the job or what, you know, if I'm going to throw a wobbly at the first bang. So we're settling down for a coffee. I think we may have got the first mouthful down, and there was a huge bang somewhere close by. The windows all came in, the lights all went out. And I sort of laughingly sort of thought, well, welcome to Iraq, you know, here we go again. And somebody dropped a mortar somewhere close, you know. And that sort of straight away, I thought, yeah, we're in the middle of something here. You know, this isn't quite as this isn't peacekeeping exactly. You know, it was decided anyway that, given that there was some activity around, that we would stay the night in the airport. So we did. We went into the area where they, you know, there were a few beds, and we kicked down for the night, and then we left the next morning. By then I'd been briefed by the Dutch boys, and I realised that I was probably going to have one of the trips of my lifetime, because the Dutch were based in Asamoah, and Asamoah is about 300 kilometres up the Euphrates. It sits on the Euphrates. And we drove all the way up the Euphrates, 300 kilometres. And I must say, a lot of the journey was just flat desert, boring desert with flaming oil wells and burnt out vehicles and gun positions and things, you know. But also you got glimpses of the river and palm trees and date palm, and it was quite a sort of biblical place, really, you know. And just breathtaking. I've got two bits in a diary I might read to you in a minute, because there's a couple of things that in a moment I'll just read. It's badly written because it's written in a tent and things, you know. But
so this would be your immediate reaction, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. If I find what have we got here? Well, this is the second day. So this is after my first night with the Dutch, and this is awfully written because I'm, you know, I've never got all my senses when I'm in these places. But I put it's Wednesday, the 14th of January, 2004. At 9:30, departed camp for escorted day with the military police. This is the Dutch military police. Three vehicles, six guys, drove southeast to Al Qaeda on the Euphrates River, walked through the town and market. My escort is very cautious. We never stray more than a few metres apart, avoid crowds or groups of people getting too close. The market was busy selling everything, shoes, clothes and food. All the food stuff was covered with flies, swarms of them. Piles of fish from the river, potatoes, swedes, cabbage, tomatoes, onions, etc. Live chicken, tiny undernourished creatures, and geese. Everyone was wanting to sell us their wares, holding up their goose or chicken for inspection, fluttering and squawking. So I went into that sort of lovely sort of Middle Eastern small town sort of atmosphere, really, which was just wonderful. I'd arrived there, and the Dutch boys said, "Well, you're the boss. We know we want you to paint, but what do you want to paint?" You know, and I didn't know what I wanted to paint. So I said, "Well, best thing is if you give me a day on everything that you're doing. So if I have a day doing this and a day doing that, then, you know." So they said, "Okay, right, we'll structure it that way." So that's what happened. So I had my first day with the military police, and they were just going around generally keeping an eye on things and making sure, checking their intelligence sources and generally watching what was going on, you know. And I had a day with their sort of special forces guys patrolling in helicopters looking for arms smugglers and that sort of thing. And in every military activity I took part in, you know, which was truly fantastic. And we'd had at the end of this first day, I've got another little bit that I could probably read to you here, I think. Yes, at the end of the first day I wrote, so this was the day when I fell for this ravaged ravaged land where the people have been persecuted and oppressed for the past 30 years. I can return home in 2 weeks, having glimpsed a way of life I could never cope with or understand, but perhaps with my paintings I can at least show the poverty, suffering and sadness of it all. Iraq had quite an impact on me, really, because it's I'm in the south. The Shia south was had suffered hugely under Saddam. I mean, he killed so many people. He'd blown up all the desalination plants on the Euphrates, and then shipped fresh water in, and if anybody was naughty, then he stopped shipping fresh water down to these people. And they'd had a hard time. And at that stage, they were really pleased to see us. because we were providing them with a certain amount of food and fresh water and a degree of security as well, you know. And we were training the new police force, which that seems to have gone a bit wrong since, you know. But I think NATO was doing its bit to help them, you know. Sadly, it's gone. It's sort of lost its focus since, I think. It's the magnet for every terrorist in the Middle East now, Iraq, you know, which is really awful. It's a great sadness. There was the odd car bomb in the locality, and there was a bit of low-level terrorism going on, but not to the extent there is now in 2007. We were doing street patrols in towns, and people were coming up to us and shaking us by the hand and saying George Bush good, Saddam Hussein bad, and all this sort of thing, you know. the Iraqis made us very welcome, which was lovely. I mean, it was delightful at that stage, but it was also quite a hostile environment, because there were a lot of people that were smuggling arms in from Saudi and places like that, and as I say, this low level terrorism that was going on, and a lot of people undercover spying, and all, so you never, you still never knew who you were with or who you were talking to. You had to be incredibly careful. I saw on that trip, I spent a day with a group of Dutch who, in their spare time, were equipping local schools, and they were raising money back in Holland and then buying equipment for the schools and helping rebuild the schools and paint the schools and put glass back in the windows, doing some great work, you know. And the local people were really appreciative of it.
And this would all have been in the one area, which was...
Well, it was the area of the province was Al Mutana.
Al-Mutana.
Which is a massive, I think it's that's like 55,000 square kilometres. So it's a huge area, which I think at that stage the Dutch looked after most of it, you know, with about 2,000.
What part of Iraq is that?
Well, this is Al Mutana is south of Baghdad, so it's loosely speaking, it's between Baghdad and Basra, and it's western Iraq, so it's west of the Euphrates and runs right out to the border with Saudi. But that sort of real humanitarian side was really interesting there, the fact that we were working really hard to help the people, and most of it was just out of compassion, you know. You could see these people were in such a mess, and people were knuckling down and doing whatever they could to help them out, you know. And it was just brilliant to see it all, but interspersed with what I was seeing there, you know. I was out patrolling, looking for terrorists and smugglers, That was really interesting, patrolling in a Chinook and spotting vehicles on lonely desert roads and dropping down and putting a roadblock in, and then leaving a group of guys with a roadblock and then dashing around to the behind the vehicle with the helicopter and putting another roadblock in, so they're caught between two roadblocks. and then going in and interrogating the drivers and taking weapons off them and things like that.
And you would have been in this situation.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And that's quite, I found that's quite, well, you're never quite sure if they're going to shoot at you, to put it simply. You know, if you can just, if you're going to stop a vehicle on a desert road, if it happens to be carrying arms, is it going, you know, are they going to open up on you or play dumb, or what are they going to do, you know? And there was one situation where they spotted a group of people in the middle of the desert, a group of people, and decided they'd go in and have a look, and we banged down in this helicopter about 200 metres from this group, and they were on a little sort of hill, you know, and we were out of the back of the helicopter and running towards these people, and everybody's armed except me. And I've got my camera, you know, and I know I was running along trying to keep up with these Marines, and thinking, you know, this can go one of two ways. And it was fine, it was all right. They were a group of lads, and I don't think we ever really found out what they were up to, but they were okay, you know, and they were searched and interrogated, and but it was fine. But yeah, that uncertainty, but that never leaves me, really, the uncertainty when you go into something, because you just don't know, you know, what might happen. And I mean, in addition to that sort of thing, I also I had my customary visit to a field hospital, but this time not as a patient, as a but I do like to go to field hospitals and have a look. In fact, behind you down there, there's a drawing of a trauma line in the Dutch field hospital.
I think I can move that.
That's all right, you can lift it up and have a look if you want. And again, I'd said, well, I'd really like to have a look at the field hospital, which quite surprised them, because I don't think most artists sort of want to go and look at field hospitals. But
it tells you a lot about the situation, though, doesn't it?
Mm, yeah.
Yes.
And again, you see people working in quite difficult conditions. I mean, they've got all their equipment, but they're in a tent, and there's sand blowing through the tent all the time, and dust and, you know, anyway, they once I said, well, I'd want to see the field hospital, the medics said, oh, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll lay on an exercise for you, because we're not getting, well, you can never predict when you're going to get a wounded person through, you know, we will lay on an exercise and show you what we do. So they did, and they wounded a Marine. And they flew this guy in, for goodness sake, just for me. They flew off, and then they flew back with a Chinook, and they hit the ground in this fort where I was. They dashed out with an ambulance, they picked him up on a stretcher from the Chinook, they dashed him into the hospital, they put him on the trauma line, and then they worked on him. All for me, so that I could get all the material I wanted. So we'd, we'd set up a picture, you know. But they were so happy to do it for me, you know, because they said, well, this will be a real problem, you know, because we might not get somebody shot to pieces for a week, you know. But oh, that was a great privilege, actually.
And that is the set-up situation, is it, for picture?
Yeah, but it was real.
It looks all very authentic.
Yeah, it was real, because everything was real,
yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Now, there were a lot of women.
Yeah, the Dutch nurses,
Dutch
military
nurses. Lots of, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the same generally, was it? Women,
yeah,
in Iraq,
yes,
and Afghanistan,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, a lot of nurses, yeah, females. Yeah. They get stuck in and do the job just like the fellas do, you know.
Yes, so the British would have that as well as the
Oh yeah, yes. I mean, the field hospital I was in Bagram, there were lots of female nurses working there who'd hardly seen the light of day for a month or two. I don't think, you know, they don't stray very far from the hospital. You know, you're kept in, you stay in the compound, and because nobody goes out much. You know, you stay in the compound and you have your time off, but all you do is read a book and sunbathe or something. There's not much you can do, you know. So it can be quite trying, quite boring, I suppose. But I mean, the way they work, I mean, they need the hours of relaxation. But you're not, you know, you go to these lovely countries, but you don't see them. You know, people like that, I see a lot more than they do. I flit around all over the place, you know. And if you're there for 6 months, at a stretch, you know, it's quite, it's quite tough.
How did you find generally being in the Iraq conflict situation? Because, as you say, although this was ostensibly peacekeeping, it was low-key war at that stage, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How would you feel about that compared with Afghanistan? Because these conflicts were going on side by side, weren't they?
They were. Yeah. I mean, I suppose the geography is different. The social structure is different. Iraq's more. I suppose you'd say a more sophisticated society than anything in Afghanistan. So you see the people handling the situation in a slightly different way, for a start. Yes, they're not more westernised, they're just more sophisticated in Iraq, and that makes a huge difference to the way you run your operations. Really, you're dealing with slightly different thought processes. They're not, I mean, Iraq's not as medieval as Afghanistan.
How about the language? Did you find many people spoke English?
Yes, quite a lot of people, especially children, could speak English. And even then, and that's quite early days, there was a lad came up to me on one patrol. He was about 10 years old, and he was obviously Iraqi, but he spoke in beautiful English with an Australian accent. And I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "Oh, we went to Australia. You know, my parents went to Australia years and years ago, and we've come back." Because
back in the war, the invasion.
Yeah, they'd returned, while thinking that it was going. They were coming home, I suppose, to a better country. You know, I suspect by now they're gravely disappointed. But a lot of people had quite a good smattering of English, and I think it was. I suspect it was taught in the schools. I would think. I mean, Iraq was quite closely allied to us, wasn't it? And I mean, we put Saddam in there in the first place, and then when it didn't suit us, we removed him.
Could he? When you went, this would be 2004.
Yes.
So Saddam hadn't been captured then, am I right? Would that be? He was caught in the December, was he not? Was it 2003?
He was caught in the December 2003.
Yes, that's right. So he would have been caught.
Yes.
He would have been in captivity,
yes,
as it were.
Yeah. I mean, they have this strange behaviour with their shoes in Iraq. If you beat something with the sole of your shoe, it's sort of the ultimate insult, really. And there were people in villages who would produce a banknote with Saddam's head on it, and they'd lay it on the ground, and they'd take one slipper off or one sandal, and they'd beat it for our benefit, you know. There was quite a lot of that sort of symbolism going on. All the while proclaiming the, you know, the attributes of George Bush, and, you know. And we, the one thing I really wanted was to find one of those great big blow-up images of Saddam. You know, all dictators have their own images, don't they? And we found one. There was one in the area where I was that had not been knocked down. It had been defaced and had all sorts of nasty things smeared on it. But it was still there and still recognised. So I did a big painting of this this image of Saddam Hussein. It was quite sort of symbolic of the place, really, you know. And I suppose at the end of that trip, I had a lot of material. I had a huge amount of material.
This would have been photographs and sketches.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Were you doing any in colour while you were there, or did you just represent the colours?
Oh, later? I did some sketches in colour. I've got sketchbooks here with bits and pieces in that I did. But yeah, I was working in watercolour, doing sketches. I mean, at least that was one thing. There were places there where you could empty places where you could see people for miles away, so you could actually sit and work for a while in safety without being having to worry about, you know, people coming at you.
This would have been really the time before the suicide bombers got going, would it?
Yeah,
be?
Yes, it was.
Had it started then?
No. No, not to any degree. No, and certainly in that area there was nothing. I mean, as I say, there was just the odd car bomb, which I suppose, yes, they may have been suicide bombings. But no, I mean, it hadn't taken off at all. And the country was, well, I can't say it was peaceful, but I mean, it was relatively under control, I suppose.
I suppose really you went at a good time, didn't you?
I think I went at the best time, because I got a flavour of the war without doubt, but I also, it was also safe enough for me to actually see things, go places, talk to people, wander along the Euphrates, and I mean, we talked to fishermen,